Welcome to the Movement Podcast. This show is all about movement. We tackle it from different angles, bring on guests, answer questions, go on a few tangents, and give practical advice, giving you guys a better idea of how you can optimize the human body to be the best it can be. Let's preview what's coming up in this episode. Our guest today is Dr. Jenna Gourlay. Jenna is a sports physical therapist, adjunct professor, and mentor based in Evansville, Indiana. She has a contagious passion for the PT industry and is driven to help empower PTs in all stages of their careers. We discuss how she went from PE to PT and the overall educational system. We talk undergrad, residencies, and give a wealth of knowledge for those early in their physical therapy journey. We shift the conversation to current physical therapists and dive into the day-to-day, the dangers of burning out, and how to avoid it. Whether you're years into your PT journey, in the middle of your education, or just interested in a physical therapy career, this episode is for you. So let's get going with today's Movement Podcast, powered by FMS. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are very excited to have Dr. Jenna Gourlay in studio here in Virginia with us. So I'm going to pass it over to her, but she is a doctor of physical therapy, as well as a FMS instructor. And so we're excited to have you. Could you introduce maybe our audience to you, kind of what your background is, how you got started in this field?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. So I actually started in the field as a physical education teacher, and that is actually what brought me to PT. So I started teaching sixth through eighth grade, and we would do this warm-up before every class, and there would be 60 kids in front of me, and we'd go through different movements. And I will not forget when we would get to the squat, I would look around, and I was amazed by what I saw, and not in a good way. There would be about 5 out of 60 kids that would be able to actually do a deep squat, and then some looked like they were trying to like levitate. Their heels were coming off the ground. Some were on the floor because they had fallen on the ground. And that bothered me. But what bothered me even more were the kids that were saying, "Ah, oh, Miss Gourlay, my knee hurts," or "Oh, my back hurts." And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you're 6th through 8th grade. So you're like 11 to 13 and you already have pain. And I watched this for, you know, the whole year that I was teaching, and it got me interested and I want to change movement. I want to fix how these kids are moving. And I was like, all right, PT school is the way to do this. So I go to PT school, fast forward through the 3 years, and I get one of my first patients in clinic, and it's a sixth grade kid, and he has knee pain. And I'm like, oh, this is what I've been training for, you know, 3 years, I finally get to use it. And he's has pain with his squat, and he squats, and it's exactly what I saw with my students years earlier. And I take him over to the table, and I look, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to look at his hips, I'm going to look at his knees, I'm going to look at his ankles. Everything that PT school has taught me, I'm going to look at. And I look at all those things and nothing's wrong with him. And I'm like, why can't he squat and why does he have pain? I just studied 3 years and I still can't necessarily answer this question. And that's what led me more to the movement and looking at it that way. But that's how I am where I am now and how I got into the system so deep.
Jenna, take us back to that decision to go from being a physical educator to a physical therapist. I mean, that's a pretty significant career change at in a young person or a young professional. How difficult was that decision? Meaning, because now you're really turning your life upside down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you go into your undergrad degree, going into physical education, wanting to be a teacher, wanting to impact kids' lives. I mean, that's why most people go into teaching. Yeah. It's not that they want their summers off. They really want to try to impact. But how difficult was that decision?
It was pretty difficult. It was difficult. I had to get some prerequisites. I had to get some of those courses down. But then it was also hard to just leave the students. They were so much fun. You know, I'd be putting on shorts and a t-shirt and I'd be going out in 70 degree weather and working with kids. But I just felt like there has to be something more that I can do. There has to be some way that I can improve the next generation more so than I knew at that time. And that's really what drove me to go back to PT school. It was a hard decision.
You know, I watched that guy go through that same evolution. He had a BS in athletic training. He went and got a master's so he could know more than most athletic trainers. On the other side of the master's, he realized, oh, it's not me. The whole profession's broken. So he went and got his PhD so he could do the same thing. And it's like you go up the next level because you think the clarity of problem solving is going to be there. But even even then in PT school, some of the things that are broken in physical education are broken in physical therapy and in healthcare in general, because the human being has changed more in our lifetime for the worse than I think ever before. And in this place in Western culture, even more so. Our culture doesn't have an explanation for why a kid who has no reason not to be able to squat can't, and it has pain doing it, because PT school prepared you to find something tight or weak, assign an exercise, maybe a temporary piece of tape, maybe a arch support. Bye-bye, go enjoy your life. That problem doesn't get fixed that way.
Well, one thing I picked up on, Jen, and speak to this is, you know, you got more education. Great, just kind of give an insight. I went back and got a little bit more higher level education, mm-hmm. hoping to get more answers.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, it only gave me maybe to ask different and better questions. Yes. And you kind of alluded to that when you went to PT school and you got out thinking, okay, now I can fix this person, but mm-hmm. quickly realized I'm only getting myself needing more answers.
Yes, absolutely. I got there and I'm like, okay, I have so much knowledge. I have so many things that I think I can work on, and I still couldn't answer any of those questions. If anything, I had more questions after I got more knowledge and after I finished school.
And I think that's where we all need to continue as a young professional. Speak to that young professional out there, Jenna, that is struggling with that. They get mm-hmm. out of PT school, just like me. I got out of my master's degree, young, cocky mm-hmm. little guy thinking, okay, I knew what I was doing. First experience was going in with Gray, realizing, shit, I don't know anything. Mm-hmm. I'm clueless.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you finish PT school and you're like, I'm going to know everything. And I remember thinking the exact same thing. And then you get the first patient in front of you that presents exactly for, you know, maybe shoulder impingement, like to the textbook. And then you do what the textbook says to fix it. And the person's like, no, I feel no better. So as a new professional, I think the big thing to recognize is a lot of it is just getting reps. I mean, the first year is so much growth and so much learning just from being there. You figure, I remember being in PT school and, you know, our professor would be like, oh yeah, you can tell that, you know, this segment is stiff. I'm like, oh, he's full of it. That segment, he can't tell that. He's just, you know, saying that. But it's because you start to feel more over that first year, especially, and you get more experience and more reps and you start to make connections that you couldn't. So new professionals, you're not supposed to know all the answers. You're supposed to have a lot of questions.
And what I know that you did, unlike a lot of therapists, is when you got out of school, you didn't assume you knew everything. And one of the things Lee and I experienced is most people graduate from athletic training, chiropractic, physical therapy, or even medical school thinking, I know how to assess, but I wish I had a bigger toolbox mm-hmm. of ways to fix, treat, and manage things. And what we realize is the toolbox they gave you in PT school is pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. But the way you look at things, the way you use your feedback loops, and the way you assess and evaluate has had to change, as I said, because the human has declined. So you came out of PT school, but you knew that wasn't enough too. You went into a residency. Mm-hmm. And I guess the one question that I'd love for you to say to anybody approaching the movement service profession, mm-hmm. whether it be coach, teacher, trainer, therapist, physician, chiropractor, whatever, is what percent of what you do now did you learn in your physical therapy degree? And what percent of what you do now did you learn after that in an intense residency that you had to be invited to? You mm-hmm. didn't just get to attend and mail it in.
Yeah. So I'd love to say that the majority was from PT school, but that would be a lie. I'd say maybe about a quarter of what I use every day was from PT school. And that's more just how to be safe and how to not harm my patients, maybe how to, you know, look at different things from a pathology standpoint. But residency is what completely ignited my career because it showed me really what I didn't know. Kyle Kiesel asked me, I don't know if I was during my residency or after my residency, but he asked me what was the best part of residency. And I thought about it and I was like, you know, if I didn't do a residency, I would have sucked and I wouldn't have known it. Like that was my answer to him. And he laughed too. And I was like, but it's so true, because the coolest part of residency was getting exposed to these different ways of thinking and getting challenged in all these different ways and developing a much greater and much deeper understanding of the profession itself.
No, it's when you challenge somebody in their professional comfort zone and they immediately become emotional instead of inquisitive, I think you know you hit somebody that really has some struggles. And and the fact that you are self-aware enough professionally, you know, it's hard enough to be self-aware personally, but if you can take that same awareness and take it to your profession and not respond emotionally or with a packaged answer that somebody else wrote, because I see so many people now asking internet questions and expecting an internet answer when they come to one of our workshops or engage with one of our instructors. And you've heard those questions too. I need you to confirm what I believe. Please don't tell me something that's going to challenge that. And the way you respond to that almost determines if you can go deeper or you just need to be 9 to 5 and check the boxes.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that, you know, we're talking about getting more professional education, going through a residency. And I think we are a continuing education company. And I think we would all agree you need, as a professional, to continue to get education. But then you have these individuals who all they do is go to continuing education seminars and get the alphabet soup behind their name. But there's got to be a balance, right? I mean, there's got to be a balance between, I mean, Jenna, you went from a residency to going through all of our continuing education. But there's a balance between just sitting in a seminar every weekend actually getting some experience.
Absolutely. I mean, the first time that I took SFMA was great and it helped me and I loved it. But it wasn't until like I struggled with it that I saw how, not magical, but how amazing it could be in my patient care once I got into it. But initially it was hard. It was like, this is taking me longer. But now it's like, I can't imagine not doing it.
Yeah, that's the one thing I think we always hear is people complain about how long it takes to get to the truth or the heart of the movement problem. Wouldn't it be better if I'm a trainer just to start with the exercise, if I'm a strength coach just to drop the program, if I'm a PT just hit them with the package and watch them? But it doesn't. The you know, Vladimir Yonda said, time spent in assessment saves time in treatment. And most carpenters know if you measure twice and cut once, you don't make many mistakes. But sometimes we don't even measure and we already got the saw out. So
for the non-PT professional, what does the education cycle normally look like for a physical therapist?
So like what you get in terms of schooling?
So how it kind of starts. And then you were talking about your residency and how that was kind of atypical. So what does it normally look like and what did you do differently?
So what I didn't know before I went into PT school is that a lot of different schools have different kind of backgrounds. So for example, like I went to Rutgers and I was really interested in orthopedics and sports and I got a good baseline there. But I think if I was interested in, say, neuro, I think I would have really enjoyed Rutgers program a whole lot more because you get everything. You're going to get acute care. You're going to get neuro. You're going to get orthopedics. You're going to get everything because that's the awesome thing about PT too is that you can go all these different ways. But for me, if I had known that, I don't know that I would have done it differently, but it definitely would have made me look into some different things. Like I remember sitting when I was doing my residency, sitting in a class at University of Evansville where I did the residency, and I'm sitting there listening to the third years, which is the last year of PT school, in an orthopedic lecture. And I'm taking notes. I'm like, I never got this in PT school. Like, this is some good stuff. And you know, their third years are like, this is fine. But I was like, no, like you don't understand. Like, this is really good. So I think that's one thing, like you get everything and you get a good baseline, but it doesn't take you to like, if you want to be the best of the best, what you learn in PT school is the foundation.
No, that's definitely a shout out to both Kyle and Phil, because they took the roadshow that Lee and I and the other guys had done and they put it in a curriculum in a way that the people that come through the residency are so much different than the people who attend our workshops. And I'm not saying the people who attend our workshops, we don't see some diamonds there. But for the most part, it's like drinking through a fire hose. And if you don't go home and work through it, and the fact that those guys stood right there and made you work through this obstacle course, get over the wall, you're going to land in a mud puddle, stand back up, keep running. And it's those reps that do it. Just all that insecurity falls right off of you when you're worried more about doing the work than memorizing anything. Cause you can memorize your way through a BS degree. You cannot memorize your way through a residency.
Yeah. I remember, one of the things that Phil told me, and I know he's told a lot of people because I've heard other people say this too, but one of the first quotes that I remember him saying was, "I'm wrong a lot, I just don't stay there." And that has stuck with me throughout because I'm watching him and I'm sure like new grads and even students can think about like clinicians that they watch and they're just like, oh my gosh, they know everything. They know exactly what to do when. They know all the answers. I don't know everything. I'm not going to be good enough. And that one quote stuck with me because I'm like, okay, it's okay to be wrong. I just have to admit that I am and figure out how to be right.
There was something that happened. There weren't formal residencies when I came out of Miami. But I was very, very pulled into the manual therapy profession, that getting in there with your hands, doing thrust manipulations, dry needling, all that was being done in the UK and up in Canada. And down here, we were still putting people on like a Biodex machine and having them kick the air. And then we put them on some heat and some ice. And so I started going up to Canada taking manual therapy courses. And when you were first talking, it reminded me the way we taught everything from strength conditioning to physical therapy and personal training is somebody would get on stage, lecture, and when the question was posed, they would give you the current evidence or the research. When I was up in Canada and they were teaching us about the neck or the shoulder and question is posed, does anybody in here have an internal rotation restriction? Yes, I do. Come on up on stage. That level of transparency, it wasn't cockiness, it was actually confidence. That level of transparency, let's solve this problem. There is real tissue standing in the room. I don't know how it's going to play out. And if I hadn't gone through that experience, I would have never done things like pulling somebody up on stage and doing a toe touch progression, or actually I'm showcasing how plastic the body is and how quickly it can change if you don't make assumptions. And if I can't prove that the body is able to change a little bit, then the problem's not functional. It's probably structural or it's a multi-system crash. But if I can prove that in a matter of moments, just messing with the neuro, like you said, because I was pulled into neuro reluctantly. I was ortho sports all the way. I had a professor who needed help over at neuro and I needed money because I needed a graduate assistantship. And she said, "You're my neuro GA." And I'm like, "But I don't want to do that." And she goes, "It's not your call. You need money and I need help." And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because that subtle adjustability in neuro is not as clean and compartmentalized as we like it to be in ortho. It's really nice when it's a knee problem, but it's never a knee problem.
Right.
It's always a knee problem plus five other things that are completely different with every person that has the same knee problem. So it's that level of transparency that I think Kyle and Phil have brought to your residency and Lee and I have brought to our practice, but it was exposed to me because I didn't have that formal thing. But it's the transparency of an instructor helps you learn to problem solve by asking better questions and not needing the answer to be the convenient one, but the real one. So
we heard from both Gray and Jenna. Lee, how was your collegiate experience? And then afterwards, what did you find it to be similar or maybe different?
He doesn't remember undergrad.
undergrad. There was a little bit of a fog.
Which is why he had to go to grad school. Yeah,
there was a fog there. I got through. No, I think, in my opinion, most undergrad degrees give you the foundation. And that's what I heard Jenna say. And I think that's definitely true. It gives you the foundation. Kind of tells you, from my background in athletic training, tells you what not to do. Like, you know, here are the things you should not do because you're going to screw up, and gives you just the information. And then you have to go out. And again, in athletic training, you have to, back then you had to get, I mean, I think I had over 2000 hours of actual experience in the training room. So that's the beauty of that profession or that undergrad experience. It's not so much what you learn in the classroom. It's taking literally what you learn in the morning, applying it in the afternoon. But at the end of the day, you're still scratching the surface. And then you go into your master's degree, which I did. The one thing about my master's degree, what I learned is it allowed me to communicate. It allowed me to, now I'm kind of more thrust into the role of, I was working at a high school. So now I was there by myself working at a high school while I was taking courses. So now I had to learn how to communicate. So to me, it was that level of being able to communicate with the parents, the coaches, the administration. And the one thing that probably helped me looking back over my career, that first job, I was working at a private school. So the parents were elite. So I was talking to physicians. I was talking to very, very smart, intelligent parents. And one thing that struck me back then is there was this kid who hurt his shoulder and his doctor was a world famous thoracic surgeon walks in, and I'm telling him, and he was just did not have any idea what was wrong with this kid. And so learning that that's a level of communication, and that built my confidence. So I think that experience, and then, you know, allowed me to then again make the decision to come and work with Gray, and then just totally being, you know, realizing I really didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And then taking it a whole different level. But it's the experience that you have to really gravitate to.
Right.
And try to, again, take in as much as you can. But the undergrad degree is, you got to get that done. It's check the box, to, in my opinion. But in the undergrad, and I'll make this last statement, I think is if there are young individuals listening, you've got to get experience in undergraduate. Don't just take the classes. Take what you learn and try to figure out whether it's an internship. I don't care if you're in business. Go find some people you know and try to get real world practical experience, even in undergrad, because I think Jenna alluded to it, because that can help. If you want to go get a master's degree, that helps determine where you may want to focus. Mm-hmm. And these two guys both said they went into orthopedics, but they got other things. And I think if you can get some real world experience in that undergraduate level, it will help direct you where you need to go as you go into your career.
And I'll say this, I definitely, of the people that graduated in my graduating class in PT school, 2 and 3 years in, I was probably making less than most every one of them, because I consciously took a pay cut and gave up that extrinsic thing for the intrinsic value. I got to work with somebody that I hold right up there with Lee and Kyle and Phil, who challenged me every day, probably way more than I wanted to be challenged. But once he started challenging me, I just got gritty and just said, I'm going to push through this. And so Paul Hughes was that guy who sort of was my 3-year informal residency that every patient I did, well, why'd you miss that? Because I'm stupid. He's, you know, and basically the answer was, no, you're not stupid. You're not systematic enough. Mm-hmm. And that is why we're sitting here right now, is that, you know, process through that. So when you get out of undergrad, you've proven you're tough, especially if you've got the 2000 hours, you proved you're tough. You haven't proved you're smart yet, but you did prove you're tough. And we appreciate that.
All right, let's take a break. And when we return, we'll continue with Jenna on career burnout and how to avoid it.
FMS One is designed for fitness, healthcare, and performance professionals who are looking to evaluate and understand how well their clients, patients, and athletes move. This is a highly interactive certification course that equips you with the tool industry leaders use to guide their programming decisions. During this course, you will learn how the 7 fundamental patterns of the movement screen relate to and affect many of our daily activities, and how mobility, motor control, and functional pattern concepts play a role in the screening process. You'll be able to identify correct screening techniques and common mistakes so your screen results are consistent and reliable. The FMS1 learning environment consists of a movement lab, performing the screen with your peers, and engaging in screening demonstrations with your instructors. Are you ready to have a reliable tool that sets a movement baseline and provides a tight feedback loop to guide your programming decisions? Take a look at our upcoming courses and get started today.
All right, so we talked a little bit about what got you to where you are now. So really, where are you now? What does your week look like? What does your day-to-day kind of look like?
Yeah, so my week is, it has a lot of variety, which is exactly how I like it to look. My predominant part of my week is in an orthopedic clinic. So I work there during the week. And then I'm the team physical therapist for the women's basketball and the women's volleyball team at University of Evansville. I teach at University of Evansville 2 courses, and then I do performance training after work sometimes. And then Friday afternoons are dedicated to working on Professional Rebellion, which is a company that Phil and I started a few years back for new grads, for physical therapists trying to navigate their career.
That's a packed week.
Give us a quick flyby of that Professional Rebellion, because mm-hmm. before you tell us all the people you're helping during the week, it sounds like a lot of people in a remote way are sort of taking your advice and mm-hmm. following in your footsteps. What kind of advice are you giving people who are interested in the movement professions, mm-hmm. and why do you call it Rebellion?
So call it Rebellion because, you know, you come out of school from physical therapy school, and I remember thinking, like, that's going to be the answer. Everything's going to be perfect after that. I'm going to wake up excited to go into work every day, and it's going to be awesome. And it was, don't get me wrong, for like the first year, every day I was excited to go in because every day was new and exciting and I was learning so much. And not that I stopped learning, but the trajectory is a lot slower after that first year. And suddenly you're sitting there and you're like, well, what's next? Like, am I just going to wake up at 9 o'clock or wake up, go in for nine and work till five and do my notes and call it a week and then go on the weekend and do it again? And, you know, that might be fine for some people, but I think the more people that I get to talk to, the more I realize that that's not the case. A lot of people are looking for something else, whether it's something they want to do on the side in addition, or whether it's something that they want to create from the ground up. And that's what we've created through the Professional Rebellion, is a way to help people get from either I don't know what I want to do next, or, you know, I just feel stuck and I know I need a change, of what they can do to create that career that does keep that excitement and does have them excited to get up in the morning.
Now, is the website like movement profession like centric?
So yeah, right now we have it directed more towards physical therapists. Mm-hmm. So it's physiorebellion.com. But our goal is to start to incorporate a lot of other movement professions as well, in terms of athletic training, chiropractors, things like that.
And it doesn't sound like, to me, hearing you describe that, it's not just geared to the younger professional. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, even a guy like me, may be out there searching for something different.
Absolutely. It's all across the profession. Cause again, we have this idea of, you know, what the best is going to be. And then you get there and you're like, well, this is good, but now I want something else, or I want something more.
Right. Especially now. I mean, right now there's a lot of changes that are happening mm-hmm. within the medical profession, telemedicine and having to do a lot more virtually. In my opinion, that's not going away. Mm-hmm. So how are you guys, give me a sense of the research you may have to do to try to make sure that you guys are staying up on top of the profession in general.
Absolutely. So it's interesting, because we have one of the things that we have is like a burnout quiz. So people will take that and we get all the data, which is really exciting. So we get to know things like how long they've been in the profession, where they are in the profession, what they do, all these different things. And then they answer these questions that determine, you know, how burnt out they feel. They're anything from, you know, I feel like I'm going through the motions every day, and you rate it like, that sounds a lot like me, that sounds some like me, or that rarely sounds like me. And it's surprising how, quote unquote, burnt out people feel in the profession. And that's across all years, and that's across different areas of physical therapy as well. So we're kind of getting a pulse there. And then just anything in the profession, the more people we talk to, the more you see these common themes.
You know, one of the things that I realized, because I have ADHD, so I burn out every day and I just change space, because I burn out on a conversation. Mm-hmm. I burn out dealing with I burn out really quick.
But so do your colleagues around you.
Yes. I burn out the room.
You burn out everybody.
No, I get it. Lee used to refer to me as like the Tasmanian devil on the Bugs Bunny cartoon. I'd come in the room, stir things up, and then leave. And then Lee sorts it back out. And maybe we're in a better place. Maybe we're in a worse place. But anyway, one of the things that I realized is I always wanted that affirmation. I wanted my patient to tell me they're better. Mm-hmm. I wanted the physician to tell me it's a good job. I wanted the coach to basically say, you're responsible because we won. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted all that. And what I really realized is most therapists on a Monday morning hope their patients had a good weekend. Mm-hmm. Because anything that went wrong in the weekend, it's because of what you did to me Thursday or mm-hmm. Friday. And so I literally had to compartmentalize this subjective information and say, unless I have a read on how you're doing other than what you interpret, unless I have a read on how you're doing other than what your physician thinks, because we're looking at different gauges. Mm-hmm. So if I'm making your movement better and you're having a bad day, I'm not getting burned out by your negativity or your insecurity. And if we're making progress, I'm not intimidated by the questions the physician's asking me. And if I say you're not playing today, I can stand at your coach and look at that and say, listen, you can do whatever you want. I'm not giving you clearance. Go get it from somewhere else. And it ain't personal. And the minute I started realizing that I've got to have a problem-solving baseline and objectivity, I don't get burnt out, because I know I do a good job even when people aren't in agreement. I know I'm making a difference even when people aren't in agreement. Now, pretty soon, if I can hold to my guns for 48, 72 hours, everything comes around and it's right there. But I used to tell patients all the time, I'm going to probably see you moving better before you're feeling better. Mm-hmm. But I will, if I don't see you moving better, we'll go deeper and we'll change something. And it's that level of calmness that kept me from getting burnout and also kept my patients having a little bit of faith in the situation. Just let's let this play out. So I realized that nobody was ever going to tell me I was doing a good job. I had to have a feedback loop that wasn't determined by anybody's subjectivity, including my own. And that helped.
So, yeah. So, Gray, you identified that, it sounds like, early on, potentially, because I certainly don't tell you you do a good job every day. But no, you identified
nobody
that.
Nobody does.
Right. You identified that's what you needed, and that's what kept you motivated and without getting burnt out. So, Jenna, my question to you, knowing what you're doing now and getting this data, what are some of the indicators someone out there can start realizing? Because you don't want to wake up 10 years from now and say, man, I started feeling burnout 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So how can you identify that or some things that people can think about in their daily activities or in their life, you know, generally speaking, that's going to say, so they can identify it before it becomes a bigger problem?
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the big things that almost happen before you feel burnt out is that you stop feeling like you're growing. So whether it's because you're not, you know, advancing yourself or because you're just used to what you're doing and you're comfortable. I think that happens to a lot of people around that maybe like 3 year mark. And again, it might be sooner or later for some people, but it's like they hit this point and they're like, well, I'm like 10 times the therapist I was, you know, in my first year, but the progress is so slow from that point because again, you know, a lot, you're like 80% really good, but that last 20% is no different than patient care. You know, you get somebody 80% better pretty easily. And that last 20% is tough, but a lot of times you'll notice like, oh, I don't feel like I'm doing anything new or I don't feel challenged. And I think that's a big part for people is maybe they want to get into, I hear a lot of people say, I want to get into X, Y, or Z. Like, oh, you know, it would be just so awesome to work with all running athletes, or it would be so great to work with swimmers and all these things. And a lot of people have these ideas of what they wish they were doing or how they wish their day would be different. And the longer that you ignore those things or just kind of say, I wish, and don't take any action towards them, the more they start to build up and that can sort of lead you towards that burnout.
One of the things that I'm always inspired by is when we look out at our courses and we see somebody right in the middle of their career. Mm-hmm. They're in their 40s, but yeah, they're showing back up to challenge their old paradigm, challenge that comfort zone. I was having a conversation with one of our good friends, Joe Van Allen, who was with us in the clinic early in the days and got the opportunity to be the physical therapist for the Patriots. Mm-hmm. The whole time Brady was there pretty much. And when Joe came back out of that situation and came back into, you know, physical therapy service for just normal people, not people with Superman capes, he goes, I don't know if I can be effective because I'm institutionalized, but many of us are institutionalized by our situation. And the number one question I used to get in the early days of teaching the SFMA, the clinical version of the movement screen, is how do I report this to insurance? It was almost like it was more important to fill out the form than it was to close the case. And I'm like, you can do both. You can easily do both, but I'm not giving the SFMA to the insurance industry. They're not interested in doing anything but compressing your visits and saving money for their shareholders. So as soon as you realize that they don't care, they're just another business, then you've basically got to close your patient's case and satisfy their criteria. And that's like running the razor's edge. I got to close this case in 6 visits when 10 would be way more convenient. Instead of letting that burn you out, I can do this thing. I can close this, but it's not, they seem to be more concerned with just getting the, it's almost like the insurance company becomes the teacher, you know, and I got a straight A again today. I filled out all my paperwork and I'm like, yeah, but all your patients are limping around Walmart looking for another clinic to go to close their case. So I am blown away when people in the middle of their career are willing to challenge some of the institution that's gotten on all of us. We show up, we do what we did because we did it yesterday without ever thinking, did I do a good job yesterday?
Mm-hmm. You got to give yourself a permission to take a risk, whether it's risk going and taking a course. Because like you said, Jenna, we all get comfortable, mm-hmm. whether it's professionally or personally, you get comfortable and we sink into that and we're good. But you gotta, that's burnout in and of itself, mm-hmm. is that you're just, you know, hit and repeat every day. So you got to give yourself permission to take a little bit of a risk and change things up.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it gets harder to be wrong or to be vulnerable as you get farther in your career. So like when you're talking about that person that's doing it in the middle of their career, that's just awesome. Because I mean, even for me, like it gets harder to ask those questions the farther you get out. And you just got to remind yourself, like, if you don't ask those questions, if you don't put yourself out there to possibly be wrong, you're not going to get better.
But it's also some of the things, like, let's take you, for example, you've got a packed week, mm-hmm. and you're doing a variety of things. But it's also the more different things, these risks you take, it's also going to let you learn what you didn't realize how much you like something. Mm-hmm. You may find, and let me ask this, you said you do sports performance. Are you now gravitating more to doing that versus something else that you're doing during the week? Are you trying to, you know, I was doing 25% sports performance 2 weeks ago. Now I want to do 30% or 40%. Lo and behold, 6 months from now, you find yourself less of a physical therapist, more sports performance. I'm not saying that's what you do,
right.
but that allows you those opportunities.
Yeah, for sure. And like, you know, people will say, oh, like Monday is usually my busiest day. I go to clinic, I work all day. Then I teach that night. And then, you know, the next Monday I'm going to be on a podcast for students. And it sounds like a packed day, like, oh my gosh, you're going to be exhausted. But on those days, I usually have more energy than on a day I just go to clinic. And that's because one of the things I've realized is for me, if I have like a teaching component, like you're saying performance, I love that too. But if I have a teaching component in my day, it shoots my energy up so high. So I think it's important to not ignore those things. Like when you are in, you know, PT school, or even when you are a PT, is like, it's okay to be interested in other things. And it's okay if you want to get into teaching or something like that. There's 1,000 ways to do it. You just have to figure out what fits you.
Yeah. Early in my career, when I was working in the clinic with Gray, I'd be in the clinic in the mornings, I'd go to the high school in the afternoons, and I'd work 12, 14, 15 hour days, but it was that variety. And then I started going to Averett and teaching, zero clue I would like teaching. Mm-hmm. I really was like, I'm not sure I like that. But I found I really like teaching, but I would get up for teaching, but as soon as I went over to the high school, I would get up again. Mm-hmm. And it was basically two totally different scenarios. And then going to a game on Friday night is another juice of energy. So that variety, I think, definitely is something people, if don't get stuck in what you're doing every day.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I think is very cool is the best learning loops we can do are get some information, have an experience, and have some reflection. And Lee got to see one of his kids on the treatment table in physical therapy and some of the stuff we were doing. 3 weeks later, he got to see the kid get a touchdown. Mm-hmm. So how many therapists actually get to see the outcomes? Because doing what we did in a small town, you think everybody that you discharge is running through a field of daisies with these brand new legs that you just gave them. No, they're at somebody else's clinic bitching and moaning mm-hmm. about the same thing they were telling you, or your parents are going to see them in Walmart and then say, well, so-and-so's not any better. And they spent mm-hmm. 2 weeks with you in a small little environment. All of your mistakes come back to you. In a large market, you think everybody you touched is perfect right now. So the contrast of treating a patient, developing an athlete, and then talking about both those things in a teaching environment force you to reflect mm-hmm. on that process continuously. Whereas if you're only at the front of the conveyor belt, if you're mm-hmm. only in the ER, you never know if these people survived or not. Mm-hmm. And if you're only at the end of the conveyor belt, you know, doing strength conditioning, you might not realize some of the problems you're causing. So it's having that upstream, downstream ability to mm-hmm. see. And that's why we had an early rule in our clinic. I made almost everybody who had a BS degree in our clinic become a strength coach. But not because we were going to be spotting anybody in a power mm-hmm. rack, because if we can't speak strength conditioning, we will have no influence after discharge. And so Lee became a strength coach. Kyle became a strength coach. Every one of our PTAs with a BS degree became a strength coach. And it was simply so we could connect in a lot of those conversations that occur at discharge or to parents, coaches, mm-hmm. athletes about how do I not have this again? Because it's not about doing your physical therapy exercises mm-hmm. for the rest of your life. It's about developing this resiliency and knowing where your weak link is.
It sounds like all three of you kind of had that feedback loop of being in the clinic and then also being a part of a sports team dealing with athletes specifically. Is that maybe one of the things you suggest to people or kind of write about that they kind of vary their, you know, the population that they work with?
I think that seeing different things definitely helps you just become better. Like the more you can see it, the same thing across different situations, the better. I don't necessarily think everybody should, you know, work with a sports team or anything like that. But for me, it was really good because it did give me that feedback. I saw, you know, 16 volleyball athletes that all had a very similar presentation, but were very different from the rest of the population that I saw. And it just helped me get better. It really helps you get that accountability too, like when you're with a team. I think that's big, but you can generate that whether you work with a team or not. And that comes back to, like, you know, that's why using the model helped me so much early in my career, is because it forced me to like test and retest to pick what I thought would help, test it out and see if it did. And I got feedback very quickly. It was kind of like in the beginning, I know a lot of people, at least I struggled to determine whether something was, you know, a joint problem or a tissue problem. It was like one of the hardest things. So I just didn't have the manual assessment skills yet. So I would pick what I thought it was based on the small amount of knowledge I have, do what I thought it needed to be done and retest it. And very quickly I found out whether what I chose was right or not. It was just the fact that I got that feedback and now I'm like, okay, well, that one worked and that felt like that. So now I'm getting some, starting to get that picture. So I think even more so than being with a team is that test and retest. Trial and error gets a bad rap, but that's how you learn, as long as you get the feedback that goes along with the error. If you never check it, you never know you're wrong.
Well, let me tell both you guys something about yourself that you may not know. Both of you are teaching and working on a national platform right now. But long before that, each of you were a resource in your community. The doctors ever come get your advice?
Mm-hmm.
The doctors get your advice? The coaches, athletes, parents, other therapists, colleagues get your advice? So there's an entire name you've made for yourself in your community that has not just made you the person that you go to when you have a knee or foot problem. You are a resource about a movement problem. Even if somebody's saying, what physician do you like for knee surgery? Because you know I'm going to do my rehab with you.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you guys established yourself as a resource in your community. And then all of a sudden, you were embraced by your state, your region, and nationally. And so being that resource and being able to have those conversations about any part of movement, from complete disability all the way to high-end performance, is something that I think everybody can do. And whether you get a national platform or not, if you're a community resource as a therapist, as a chiropractor, as an athletic trainer, and people are coming to you from more than just your little niche, mm-hmm. you demonstrate that you're not institutionalized yeah. anymore by one title. So, yeah.
One thing I want to follow up on. I'm sorry, but one thing I don't want coming out of this, because we all were very fortunate. All of us around here have done a variety of things within the profession, whether it's sports teams, whether it's teaching, what strength and condition, whatever it is. But there's plenty of people out there that are just going and getting up, going to therapy, having a positive mm-hmm. impact on people, mm-hmm. and then leaving. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? As long as they are having something outside of that that's continuing to drive them. You know, so it's you know, we're talking about burnout. There's plenty of people that are doing the same thing that are comfortable every mm-hmm. day, that don't need to do a variety of things and work with a variety of people. But in order to keep them from getting burnout, there's still things that they need to be doing maybe outside of the profession. Maybe mm-hmm. that they have other things that interest them that are keeping them, you know, growing maybe more personally, not necessarily much professionally, but they're yeah. just as productive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I have coworkers that are really into running and really into different things on, you know, for themselves. And I mean, that drives them just as much as anything else. I think the common thing I see is you just have something that you're trying to get better at, you know, whatever it is, that's what's driving people, not necessarily one thing, but it's like, you don't want to just be average. And maybe you find that in a different way outside, but you want to get better.
So, at the beginning of this episode, we talked about what led you from PE to PT.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just very curious as a listener. So let's say now a child were to experience knee pain, or maybe display some of the things that you saw in that original classroom that you were in. You know, how would you go about that now with all the experience and knowledge you've gained over the years? What would maybe be the first step? What would you do differently now for that child? And I know obviously it's case by case, but just a, you know, an average kind of story, you know, what would you do differently for that child?
So the big piece that I was missing from PT school and from my previous education was I didn't understand motor control and stabilization and things like that. I thought it was all anatomy and all, you know, range of motion and all these things. But especially when you're working with kids, it comes down to, you know, can they balance? Can they breathe? You know, can they do those foundational things? And if they can't, then a lot of times you see those problems. So I think a big thing that I was missing was I haven't seen many kids that are actually truly stiff. I've seen kids that can't move well because they've created some sort of stiffness because they can't move well. And that was the big piece that I was missing as a PE teacher. And also in the beginning of my career was I was just assuming that it was an anatomical problem. These kids didn't have any pathology or any anatomical problem. They like Gray was saying, they just didn't get the exposure to movement that, you know, maybe I got and maybe other people got growing up. They just didn't experience that.
Right. Well, Jenna, thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate it. It's awesome to have you here in studio with us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jenna.
Thanks for having me.
That'll do it for this episode of the Movement Podcast. Thanks for listening. And if you liked what you heard, please take a minute to subscribe, share, and review. If you want to learn more about our system and take the next step in your movement journey, visit us at movementpod.com. Until next time, remember to first move well, then move often.